It's on Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist Robert Corum is used to writing about other people's lives. He's written a number of biographies. But his new book focuses on his own life. It's called Gully Dirt, on exposing the Klan, raising a hog, and escaping the South. And Robert Corum joins me in our studio. Welcome back.
Good morning.
So, I mean, I have to ask first what gully dirt is.
Gully dirt is the sorriest dirt on earth. It's what's left when the topsoil and the substrate wash away. It's dirt that is good for absolutely nothing.
And why is that the title of your memoir?
My father frequently told me that I was sorry as gully dirt, and I thought that would make a good title.
So this, you are a much braver person than I. I mean, I have to say, this memoir is just ruthlessly honest. You reveal things I don't think I've ever read in a memoir before in my life. How difficult was that?
I think anyone who writes a memoir winds up in need of a therapist. And my goal was to dig deeply and to be honest. And I think I was too honest and perhaps dug too deeply. And I paid a price for it.
What do you mean?
I excavated some things that might have better been left buried. And I've been supporting the mental health industry for a couple of years because of this book.
I have to assume that one of the things you're talking about in terms of excavation is the relationship with your father.
Yes.
Who was a veteran from the Army and, by all accounts, a fairly brutal man.
That he was.
Some of the scenes in there with your father are really tough. They were tough to read, so I have to imagine they were difficult, even after all these years, to write. How have you grappled with that, and why are you just coming to write about it this much further on?
I've been working on the book off and on for about 30 years, a sentence here and a paragraph there and a scene here. And about 10 years ago, I guess, started putting it all together and dividing it up into chapters. And about 5 years ago, I finished another biography, and I said, it's time to do the memoir. I've been working on it, playing with it for long enough, so I spent about a year and a half writing it.
So another thing, I mean, just to go back to with your father, one of the things that you describe are some public beatings that you got at your father's hand. And it's brought home very painfully the difference between a beating you sustain at home versus one in the light of day with everyone watching. Why do you think he did that? Have you had any further understanding on him and his motivation?
He spent 30 years in the Army and was used to punishing recruits, I suppose, and there were always other people around. So the night I got baptized in the Baptist church, as I was going down into the baptismal pool, I said, "Good gosh, this water's cold," something like that. And he pulled me out of line after church, and as other people were streaming out of the church, he was beating me with a belt right there at the foot of the steps.
What do you think that did to you? Do you even remember what you were thinking at the time?
It was a little humiliating, embarrassing. And my dad wouldn't let me cry when he beat me like that. I had to just plant my feet and stand there. And today I find that I cry a lot. I cry reading roadmaps. And I ask my therapist about it, and he said because I was not allowed to cry as a child, that I have a lot of tears backed up. So the wounds were deep, and they're writing the memoir enabled me to learn about myself in ways I never had before, and to know things about myself that I just had never connected the dots before.
So I wonder how much your feelings over your father were wrapped up in your feelings with the South. Could you have separated your memories of growing up in a very small town in rural Georgia from your relationship with your dad?
He was from Southwest Georgia, and after he retired, we lived up in around Pine Mountain for maybe a couple of years and then went back to deep Southwest Georgia. So his family settled that part of Georgia in the 1840s, and the family's been there for many, many generations. And I'm part of that, whether I like it or not.
Well, let's talk about whether you like it or not. And I have to say, as I was reading this book, I was reminded of a line from a Faulkner novel when someone asks one of his characters, why do you hate the South? And his answer is, I don't hate it. I don't hate it. I don't hate it. And when I was reading your memoir, I kept thinking about that. Yeah. Do you hate Edison?
Well, first, thanks for the comparison to Faulkner. I like that part. I have mixed feelings about Edison. I'm from there, but my earliest memories of Edison are wanting to get out. I was one of only two boys in the class. It was a class of 22, 12 boys and 10 girls. And I was one of only two boys that did not come from a farming family. So I was separate from everybody. I couldn't rebuild a transmission on a tractor. I didn't like to go bird hunting. It really bothered me to kill birds. I didn't like talking about the Civil War as if we were in a lull between battles. I was not an ancestor worshiper. There was nothing that everyone else talked about that was even on my radar screen. So I was an outlier from the beginning, and I just wanted out. I thought it was some cosmic joke that some spaceship was flying between New Orleans, New York, and L.A., and they just, this cosmic whim threw me out over deep southwest Georgia because I never belonged there.
So, one of the really great, the whole book is written so vividly, it's quite easy to picture, but one of the great early stories you tell is your trip to Valley Forge with the Boy Scouts. And it struck me, your description of all these boys on traveling up there, and they all brought their Confederate flags. That was your first trip out of Edison, right?
It was, and there were a group of us got on in Albany, it's come to Atlanta and from there to Washington, and in Albany, everybody who got on was wearing one of those little Confederate hats and waving a battle flag or had it on their backpack. In Atlanta, everyone from Georgia gathered together, and the whole train was full of people doing rebel yells. And we were going to a place where our country was formed and making the battle cries of someone, those who tried to break the country apart.
I mean, this book deals with your young life. This isn't all of Robert Corum's life. This is the beginning of it, and we start to see through it your very earliest thoughts about race. How did you? Judging from what you're describing growing up, I wonder how you came to not be racist.
Well, I was early on. I grew up in a very racist time and surrounded by racists, and that was what I was taught. There's a line in South Pacific that says you've got to be carefully taught, and I was. And it was a book by Frank Yerby, I think, that started turning my thinking around. I discovered him when I was about 14, and I thought he was the greatest storyteller I'd ever come across in my life. And I read his book. Book after book after book, and finally I found one. There was a dust jacket on it, and I turned it over, and he was black, and I just couldn't gather that, given the way that I had grown up, and that a black man had written the greatest book I had ever read, and he was a bestseller. His first book became a movie, and oddly enough, he left about the time I graduated from high school. He left to Georgia and went to Spain. He said he could no longer stand the racism in his home state. So that was the beginning. But
you said that you still keep his book by your bedside. Which one is it?
The Foxes of Hara. I read it every year.
If anyone has not checked out the books of Frank Yerby, he wrote a number of them, A Woman Called Fancy, yeah. Judish My Brother, and Born in Augusta, Georgia, great, great books. If you're just joining us, I am speaking with Robert Corum. His new memoir is called Gully Dirt, on exposing the Klan, raising a hog, and escaping the South. But the Klan is a character in your young life and in the book. How did people talk about it, or did they?
They didn't. We were very much aware of the Klan and some of the things that they were alleged to have done. And one day, some friends of mine and I going down a road that was being paved, and there was a Klan house there, and we found their robes. And in the top of each hat was the name of the owner, and it was some of the most prominent people in the county, school teachers, professional people, farmers. I knew every name I ran across in there. And I kept digging deeper in this big chest where all the robes were, looking for a robe with my dad's name on it, because somehow I sensed that he had a robe in there. And I never found it, and I never knew for sure that he was a member, but I believe that he was.
You know, many of the things that you describe in your book are just, as I've mentioned, incredibly honest. You talk about your early sexual experiences with really, in some ways, amusing. I mean, you clearly have a sense of humor about it. But brutal honesty in many ways. Why? Why include that? How does that help your book?
I thought the story was so bleak that there had to be some humor in it. Were there not, it would be like Schindler's List without the happy ending. And a lot of the things that happen to kids are humorous when you get a little distance and look back on them. And the humor was an important part of the book. And the I'm not sure I would call them, well, sexual scenes, but it's more romance, because I had a very... I'm an incurable romantic and have been from the very early days. And I think that those scenes are described in a romantic, loving moonbeam and pixie dust sort of light. And I think that women, if they're still alive, who read that, would be like it, that their first boyfriend remembered them in such a nice way. I like
and in
to
such
think
detail.
That, yeah. Well, okay.
What... you have a very little patience in this book for the romantic ideas of the South, the misty sort of Vaseline-smeared lens that many people often talk about. You call it claptrap. Did you have that as a kid? And when, if so, when did it disappear?
I think there are many Souths. There's the Old South, the New South, the Romantic South, the Faulkner South, the Moonbeam and Magnolia South. But I came from the hard South. It's a brutal South, a racist South, where the Klan was there. And the people are very narrow, and they are, it was like living in a medieval city. People rarely went out of the city limits. It was a big deal to go up to Columbus, over to Albany, which was 40 miles away. And it was a restrictive, confining, narrow, judgmental town. And that... most people love their hometowns, and I have a hard time with that, because I never fit in, and all I ever wanted to do was get out. And perhaps I'm a traitor to my roots. I don't know, but that's I was from the South, but not of the South.
And yet one of the things you point out is that Edison was not anti-Semitic, which made it different, unique, yeah, among the other rural towns. Why was Edison free of that particular kind of bigotry?
The most prominent family in town was a Jewish family, and Mr. Bill Israel, who owned the local department store, while I was in high school, was voted not the man of the day or the man of the week or the man of the month. He was voted the man of the century. A Jewish guy in Southwest Georgia voted the man of the century, and he was the pillar of Edison. Everybody loved him. So I didn't know until I left Edison that there were people who were anti-Semitic. I'd never heard of that. I couldn't imagine it.
You end quite, as I mentioned, quite early in your life. Are there more memoirs coming? Is this a part one?
That was the painful one, and it was very difficult. Yes, there is another one. I'm 200 pages into it, and it... I'm really having a lot of fun writing this one. It's not as bleak as the first one.
So you have written four biographies, a number of biographies of other people.
Yes, yeah.
Did it help you or hurt you that you were already pretty able at talking about other people's lives?
It was a help. I wrote seven novels that were easily forgettable, and I learned to write in writing those novels, so they served some benefit. And I did a couple of... biographies with other people, collaborations, and it was an easy segue from that into biographies. And my biographies read like novels, and it's been an evolution. So.
But were you tempted to leave things out, to clean up some of the obvious heartbreak of your childhood?
No, I think if you're going to write a memoir, that number one, you have to be honest, absolutely brutally honest, and you can't think of the consequences of what you're, or the fallout of what you're writing. You just, as I said, you have to dig deep and be absolutely honest. And I never thought about any fallout. It's happening now, but I had never thought of it.
What do you mean it's happening now?
Well, they're not going to be holding any parades for me in Edison. And people are saying, how could you treat your hometown that way? And what will people in other parts of the country think? And I want to say, do you think people in New York or Omaha or Chicago, if somebody writes something critical, do they say, oh, my, what are those people in the South going to think of us? No, they don't. They don't care. So why should we care? But we do. The South has a great inferiority complex regarding the rest of the country. And I think they're afraid that some of the stereotypes about the South might be true.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but the fact of the matter is that you escaped the South and then came back.
Well, in many ways, Atlanta is not the South. Atlanta's the new South, and outside the perimeter is still the old South. And I don't consider Atlanta, except in the very broadest sense, to be part of the South.
That is journalist Robert Corum. His memoir is called Gully Dirt on Exposing the Klan, Raising a Hog, and Escaping the South. It is a good read. Robert Corum, thank you so much.
Thank you.